Hello, this is Brad Schwartz, professor and chairman of Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. On behalf of Richard Wolf Medical, the Endourological Society, and the Journal of Endourology, I would like to welcome you to the latest release in our podcast series. Each month, we will be presenting a current events topic of interest to our listeners.
Welcome to another podcast for the Endo Society. I'm Brad Schwartz. And today we have Dr. Chris Netsch from Hamburg, Germany. He's the assistant professor of urology and a fellow in endourology and a fellow of the European Board of Urology, here to talk to us about aquablation for benign prostatic hyperplasia. Chris, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning to everybody. Thank you for joining.
So, Chris, I guess the first question is, you know, I think aquablation is still somewhat new and maybe unknown to a lot of practitioners. Maybe if you could just give us an idea of how it works, what some of the mechanisms are, how is it different than, some of the laser enucleation and the resume and the UroLift and the TURP and the stents and the embolizations and so on?
So the primary idea of aquablation is somewhat standardization of prostate surgery. So this was the primary idea. So we have a robotic procedure. That means we, first of all, we put in an ultrasound probe transrectally. So we are measuring the prostate volume, which is after that resected by a water beam, probe, which is inserted transurethrally. So we have a defined ablation of prostate tissue transurethrally, and we can use the ultrasound probe to find the exact volume of the tissue which we can ablate. So this was the initial idea. So there are, of course, some pitfalls of the technique. So one pitfall is that we cannot resect 360 degrees. We can just to a maximum of 180 degrees resect with the water beam the prostate. So all in all, it's more a piece of cake what we can resect with aquabeam from the prostate. And so we cannot resect the part at the 12 o'clock position of the prostate when you look transurethrally to the prostate. So I think this might be one drawback, because we cannot resect. We do not have a complete removal of the prostate tissue as an enucleation of the prostate. So, and if you want to say that the PSA reduction rate is a marker of completeness of prostate ablation, we have a PSA reduction rate with enucleation procedure somewhat around 80 to 90%. And with aquablation, something between, according to the technique, something between 40 and 60%. However, the idea behind this procedure is to standardize it, to have a standardized ablation, to reduce the learning curve of the procedure. That was one of the ideas behind that. We can do a standardized procedure that we can safely protect the sphincter area, that we can protect the eoculation area around the baromontanum. That's also an issue. Yeah, that was the initial idea behind it. Before they started with the studies, I think the well-known studies, it's the Water 1 study and the Water 2 study. Water 1 was a prospective randomized trial comparing TURP with aquablation. Prostates between 30 and 80 grams were included in this series. It was a non-inferiority trial, and according to the primary outcome parameters, aquablation was non-inferior to TURP in this series. Since then, they have published the 6-month data, 12-month, 2 years, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year data, and found good long-term outcomes with this procedure. However, this is an industry-sponsored trial, of course. Every procedure was done or in combination with the proctor of the company. Of course, then you have different results to independent studies. And so it's difficult to compare data from water to a real world data from the Water 1 study. Water 2 study is a different study. It's about prostates with volume above 80 cc. I think it was a single arm trial with a mean volume of 107 milliliters. And of course, also 1 year data, 2 year data, until up to 5 year data. And they have also a good long-term outcome. However, it's also a non-independent, it was also an industry sponsored study. since then, we have just a few other publications which are besides the water studies, Water 1 and Water 2. One major issue was the preservation of ejaculation, and in the studies published with this technique, we have an ejaculation preservation somewhat between 66% and 96%. This is, of course, interesting for younger patients, let's say patients around 45 years who have problems with micturition and want to have an adequate ejaculation. I think then this procedure might be an issue for those patients.
So Chris, let me just, you mentioned standardization. So the goal is to standardize. Just correct me if I'm wrong, but the standardization process is across all prostates and all men, or is it just mainly is it mainly a means of simplifying the procedure for the user?
Yeah, it means that you simplify the procedure, that you simplify it in that way that the learning curve is shortened, that you have a shorter learning curve compared to TURP or laser enucleation. That was the main idea behind it.
And what have you seen to be from some of these maybe non-independent studies? What have been some of the complications, or the clear advantages and the clear disadvantages of this procedure?
I think one argument for aquablation is that the aquablation time is something around 4 to 5 minutes. The pure ablation of the prostate tissue. However, this short ablation time is not the complete OR time. Finally, you have an OR time of 60 minutes. And of course, you have a learning curve. It's also like in any other procedure, you have a learning curve. I think that's a major drawback to what is published, because it's from my own experience, you need about 20 to 30 procedures to understand what you are doing and what you are looking for with your ultrasound probe. So the major complications with this procedure are bleeding issues, of course, because the primary idea was also to reduce the dysuria. The idea was that if you use bipolar or monopolar energy, this has an effect on dysuria, or if you use laser energy, and then the idea was that you have an athermal prostate ablation process. This was the initial idea, to do it athermal. So first of all, they did it without any coagulation, any coagulation of the prostate. They just use a catheter with a bladder, with a balloon in the bladder, and use a traction device to reduce the bleeding issues. But finally, it was published that it's better to do coagulation with the loop, and I think that's another drawback because if you use the water beam, which is called thermal, of course, and finally use a loop to do a coagulation at the level of the bladder neck and to resect what it's called the fluffy tissue. That's a tissue which you resect with the loop at the end of the aquablation procedure. Then it's also difficult to understand what is the primary effect of aquablation and what is the effect of your bipolar loop. So that makes for me as a scientist difficult to understand the papers and the effects. So
early on, someone who might adopt this technology, they might be they might be asked to anticipate definitely doing kind of a dual procedure. They'll do their aquablation. Yep. They'll kind of see what some of the effects are, but they might expect or understand that they have to break out the TERP loop or some coagulation device to potentially help them maintain.
Finally, it's a hybrid procedure now. You use the loop for coagulation issues and for resecting some of the fluffy tissue in the prostate. I think that's a drawback for me as a surgeon, because it's what I call Star Wars in the OR. You need a lot of instrumentation for the procedure. That's one issue. And the other issue, what's also important, is we all know we have a lot of patients under antiplatelet therapy, under oral anticoagulant therapy, and it's difficult to do those to treat those patients with a water beam. So it's just possible to do aquablation therapy in patients under aspirin therapy, but it's not possible, or I would not do it. I'm not sure whether it's forbidden to do it under anticoagulant therapy in the US. I would not prefer it because of the bleeding issue. So that's the drawbacks, the major drawbacks. It's a bleeding issue and it's not resolved.
Is there a technologist or someone familiar with the equipment? Do they need to be present for every single case? Does someone need to run the equipment and the measurement device and the actual heating device to for this procedure to be successful? Or can the surgeon and just the standard operating room personnel eventually get to where they need to be with this alone?
That's a good question. To be honest, the learning curve for aquablation does not only refer to the surgeon, but also to the OR nurse, because it's complex instrumentation. And from our own experience, also the OR nurse needs about 5 to 10 cases to understand what they have to prepare before surgery and what is needed during the surgery, because the setup of the machine, it's a computer. It's, you have the ultrasound probe and the ultrasound machine and the water beam probe, and they work with the computer, and the complete setup must also be prepared by the OR. So it's really more complex than initially thought, to be honest.
So you mentioned to me off air that it's not available in Europe yet. What is your anticipated avenue for this device to be available in Europe, and how does it get approved, and what is the timeline that you see?
Well, what is not approved in Europe?
Oh, is aquablation available in Europe?
Yes, of course. It's available.
I misunderstood you. I apologize. And so, you know, we were talking in the United States, it's still not available everywhere. I think it's somewhat limited in its availability. How is it available in Europe, and are there a lot of centers using it?
To be honest, it's a matter of price also. The device, the price for the device, it's somewhat between 100,000 and 300,000K. So 300K. So it's also a matter of reimbursement by the medical insurance companies, and that depends also on the different medical insurance systems in Europe, all over Europe. So, for example, in Germany, it's an expensive procedure with regard to the sum you get from the insurance company. So normally, an aquablation procedure is reimbursed with €3,500, and the complete material, single way material you need for the procedure is something between 1,300 and €1,600 per procedure, compared to a laser enucleation, where you just use your single use or multi use laser fiber, and the cost for sterilization, which is per procedure something between, I would say, €300 and €400. So it's a very expensive procedure, to be honest, the aquablation procedure.
Getting back to some of the patient characteristics, who do you see the ideal patient for this procedure? Is it a big gland, small gland, middle, low?
I would say the best procedure, the best patient for the procedure is something between 40 and 80 cc without a middle lobe, because it's difficult to treat with the water beam a middle lobe. From my personal experience in patients with a large middle lobe, you need the loop to resect the loop completely, because when the water beam hits the middle lobe, how can I describe it? It's jumping away. It's jumping in front of your water beam. You can see it in real time at the monitor, and this makes it difficult to treat patients with a middle lobe with aquablation therapy alone. So, and also if you treat patients with prostates over 150 cc, you need a lot of experience, because it's not as in smaller glands where you just need the ultrasound probe and one adjustment of the prostate and then the treatment. In glands over 150 cc, it's a staged procedure where you need four and sometimes three to four adjustments of the ultrasound picture before you start up the procedure, because this is one of the limitations, because you have the length of the ultrasound probe and the length of the prostate. And as you know, in some prostates, if you put in the ultrasound probe into the rectum, the prostate is getting longer. In other cases, the prostate is not going into length. It's more it's brightened, and that makes it very difficult. If the prostate is really long, then you need three to four adjustments to completely treat the patient with aquablation. And also after each treatment, you see not the clear clear view of the prostate fossa, because you have also the effect of the first treatment, of the first pass of the water beam. Then you have in your ultrasound picture a lot of interferences with bloodstream or stream of tissue, what moves in front of your ultrasound picture. So it's not easy. So you need a lot of experience if you want to treat larger sized prostates with aquablation.
Okay. Well, I'd like to have you maybe close and summarize kind of your view or your opinion of aquablation and how kind of a urologist might picture the treatment technology in their practice. We only have a couple minutes left, and I'd like you to maybe summarize for the audience what your views are on aquablation.
I would say aquablation is the best, or is a good treatment for patients who are interested in antecrat ejaculation and preservation of antecrat ejaculation. It's for younger patients, I would say. Patients, let's say, between 45 and 65 years, with prostate volume something between 40 and 80 grams. Without anticoagulant treatment, I think then you can expect the best results. And with I would say, somewhat of a standardized prostate, enlarged prostate, but standardized prostate. In any patient with other, what I would call complicated things, more a large size prostate, anticoagulant treatment, you need an alternative treatment for those patients. We just have, to be honest, we just have two studies with long-term data, with five-year data. It's Water 1 and Water 2. And this both studies were sponsored by the company. So we do not have independent long-term data. And I think that's the lacking of real long-term data, of independent data, is something what's still lacking and what it makes difficult to compare this treatment to, let's say, laser enucleation, TURP, or open surgery or robotic surgery of benign prostatic hyperplasia.
All right, fantastic. Chris, we really appreciate your time this morning. Dr. Chris Netsch from Hamburg, Germany, lending his insights on aquablation and how it might be used in one's practice. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise. And
thank you.
Look forward to seeing you.
On behalf of Richard Wolf Medical, the Journal of Endourology and the Endourological Society, I thank you for listening today and hope you can tune into the next podcast.